Good morning. I'll call the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee to order. The first order of business is to approve the minutes of February 2nd. Representative Lunan moves those minutes. Discussion? All those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are adopted. We'll get right to our agenda this morning. Representative Albright is already at the testifiers table. Representative Smith, would you like to move House File 474?
I would, Madam Chair. So moved.
Thank you, Representative Smith. The motion is to move before the committee and recommend that it be referred to the General Register. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning. House File 474 is a technical fix that is required to permit the compact to function as it was intended to function. And does not change the compact or alter the traditional licensure in Minnesota. Just as a reflection in terms of the history of this bill, the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact was unanimously passed by both chambers in 2015. The legislation enabled Minnesota to join an interstate commission that will permit qualified physicians to obtain expedited licensure in other compact member states. And members, the key point that I want to reflect upon for the purposes that this House file is before this committee is the Minnesota statute that authorizes criminal background checks is not sufficient to allow criminal background checks required under the compact per the federal authority that conducts those background checks. And so that is why we are before this committee this morning, is to fix and correct that oversight. This will permit the compact licensure background checks to take place. It will also allow physicians who have passed a federal criminal background check requested by another compact state who wish to obtain an expedited Minnesota license. This compact was passed unanimously, supported by the Board of Medical Practice. I have Ms. Ruth Martinez with me this morning. She can help to explain any technical devices that are under consideration by this committee. I will just leave with this, that the data from the criminal background checks will not be shared with the Interstate Compact Commission. Only the result will be shared with the physician's permission. I know that is something that would pertain to this committee, so I'll just leave it with that. And with your permission, Madam Chair, I'll turn over the remainder of my time to Ms. Martinez.
Very well. Please introduce yourself to the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Chair Scott, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Ruth Martinez. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Practice, and I would just emphasize a couple of the points that Representative Albright has shared with you, and specifically that this is a technical housekeeping fix to the Medical Practice Act to enable us to participate in the compact and issue licenses through that process. Of significance, the concerns arose around sharing of criminal background check data. There is no sharing of criminal background check data by a principal state of licensure. So the criminal background check is authorized in this section so that we may conduct a criminal background check for individuals who already hold Minnesota licenses. In the current section of 214 authorizing criminal background checks, it's for only for new applicants for licensure. So as a principal state of licensure, we will be conducting the criminal background check for a current licensee who wishes to participate in expedited licensure across state lines in member states. It also allows us to exempt someone coming in from another state who has undergone that criminal background check in a principal state of licensure to apply for an expedited license in Minnesota without having to repeat that criminal background check that's required under Section 214.075. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like some clarification on that. So if someone has a background check in another state, how do we know that that state's background check was as comprehensive as Minnesota's background check? Because not every state, of course, puts all of their information in all of the databases that one might have to check.
Ms. Martinez.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, thanks for that question. The criteria for the background check are actually part of the interstate compact itself, so it's not criminal background checks pursuant to each individual state. So the requirements are it has to be an FBI criminal background check, and the language about that is within the compact itself. So all member states have to conduct a similar level criminal background check. I don't know if that gets to your question.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we conduct background checks, we also tend to look at any civil discipline when we do some of those kinds of things when we're doing licensing. If you are exempting someone from having another background check here, are you going to miss the opportunity to look at those other kinds of things? We just saw a news story about people taking drugs in hospitals. That they said that there were discipline issued, but that no criminal charges were ever brought. So would we be exempting from looking, would we stop Minnesota from looking at those kinds of things to see if there are other issues out there other than just criminal convictions?
Ms. Martinez.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know if I can specifically answer that question because I'm not familiar with all of the other things that other states might be looking at. I do know that it's a comprehensive criminal background check. It's fingerprint using fingerprint data through the FBI. I don't know if I can fully answer that question in the moment.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, I'll be asking those questions on the House floor if this bill should move forward. Members, one of the things that we have found in Minnesota is that we like to give people second chances here in Minnesota. And so there are many things that happen that don't ultimately end up in a criminal background check or show up on a criminal background check. Mm. For example, whether or not you've been convicted of a drug offense, the conviction would show up. But if you receive some other kinds of diversions and you receive some other kinds of programs, which we encourage here in Minnesota, those wouldn't show up necessarily on an FBI background check. Mm. And so we want to make sure that we are making sure that our background checks are good and that in Minnesota we have the ability to protect our residents, encouraging all of those other processes to work so people can continue to work, but yet not leaving the door open so that we don't catch the folks that we should, especially if they've had a recent incident. So I would ask that you look closely at whether or not this is the right step.
Thank you. Other member questions for the testifier or the bill's author? Seeing none. Those are good points that Representative Hillstrom made, so I hope Representative Albright, you'll find the answers to those questions. Seeing no further questions, Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 474 be passed and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to the General Register. Thank you for being here, members. Bright and early this morning. He's coming from across the hall. All right, go ahead. Are you his first testifier?
Yes, sir.
All right, if you could go ahead and have a seat. We'll wait for Representative Backer to get here for House File 324. There he is. Good morning, Representative Backer. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair and committee members.
Representative O'Neill will move House File 324 and recommend that it be re-referred to the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. To your bill,
okay.
Representative Backer.
Chair and members, thank you for this opportunity to be in front of you today. The replica bill, House File 324, is a unique piece of legislation that is modeled and designed for EMS providers across the United States. Replica would allow compact states' EMS workers to work across state lines under the guidance of a home state licensing and certification laws. And I'd like to repeat that because we've had a lot of questions. It does, for example, like myself, our service on Western Minnesota, we go into two states, into South Dakota, Minnesota. When I get back tomorrow, I'll be on call for 24 hours and generally I take weekend shifts. So when I get a run into South Dakota, this would allow me to practice in South Dakota without obtaining a license. So we as EMS providers in Minnesota still work under our Minnesota board. So I want to clarify that because there's been questions about that. Currently, we have 7 state legislators who've passed replica with 8 more on the dock so far for this legislative cycle. We would like Minnesota to be one of them. One of the reasons this have came up is when we see these national disasters, like with hurricanes, and they ask for help, we as firefighters or EMS, I'm not a firefighter, EMS, paramedic, or firefighter, if we get called, like we have a strike team in Minnesota, there's paperwork that has to be done before we can go and provide aid in those type of emergencies. This would simplify the process and allow us to help other Americans in time of need, just on not like the day-to-day activity that I do when I get called out and so forth. So this compact becomes effective when there's 10 states when they enact this, and so we're looking for Minnesota to be one of them. Today I have Buck with me with the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I'll turn it over to him.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. McAlpin. Please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, Buck McAlpin here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. This has been a bill that our Ambulance Association's vetted the last few years, and we decided to bring this forward this year after a work group met numerous times and went through it. And I'm sure, like you've seen with other compact bills that were before you in the last bill, very extensive bills, and they set up very extensive relationships from state to state. And this compact bill, mostly, as Representative Backer said, we do a lot of border work with our EMS operations. And most importantly, this bill was came and pushed for our association from our air medical companies, North Memorial, Mayo, Lifelink, Sanford, ones that do work within all these states and travel long distances. And it's been quite costly to certify and license them in multiple states. This has nothing to do with ambulance licensure and the oversight by our State Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. They still have that control. But like other compacts you've seen, this sets up a database where we share data between states. I think it's probably something this committee is very interested in. And so our EMS data warehouse of about 31,000 EMTs and paramedics, once we pass the compact, and the compact has to hit 10 states, as Representative Backer described, then it becomes active, and the compact forms the commission that starts to meet and start to develop rules and looks at how they bring in other states to the compact. One of the weaknesses with it is that some of the bordering states, they may decide to do it tomorrow or 5 years from now, and if North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin don't enable the compact, we really have a compact that's okay if Jeff and I get called to do ambulance work in New Orleans, but some of the day-to-day operations, I think, is some of the bigger concern that's come out of our association. We've met and tried to work with some of the bordering states to say, let us know what we can do to help you to make sure if we do this that it's beneficial to our EMS providers.
Thank you. I think what we'll do first is go through all the testifiers' testimonies, and then we'll bring them back for questioning. Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Please stand by there. Chris Parsons, president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, is next. Good morning. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. We represent about 1,700 paramedics, EMTs, firefighters in 41 communities around the state of Minnesota. And I'm here with my good friend, Fire Chief from Richfield, Wayne Kiewicz, and he is representing the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. And we're here to speak this morning in opposition to this bill. Simply put, House File 324 is wrong for Minnesota. It's a step towards removing Minnesota's sovereignty over our EMS services in lieu of a federal administration of EMS in Minnesota. This type of legislation was originally requested by the federal government to facilitate the movement of EMS resources across state lines in the event of certain critical life safety emergencies. However, this legislation goes well beyond those intentions. It's 19 pages of completely new legislation that will have far-reaching and negative consequences and has the potential to erode the high level of service we provide. Almost as troubling as the enormity of the changes proposed in this bill is that it cannot be altered to make it more palatable to the state's stakeholders. This bill takes control of our EMS services out of the hands of Minnesotans and places it in the trust of a multi-state commission. This commission will be given broad authority to regulate EMS providers crossing state boundaries. The commission will operate without proper oversight and will be unaccountable to the people. Another major area of concern and of special interest to this committee should be that HF 324 allows out-of-state ambulance services to operate within our borders on a routine basis, even if they are not licensed to operate within our borders. Further, these out-of-state services may employ paramedics whose criminal backgrounds would be disqualifying for certification in Minnesota. In fact, this proposed compact does not require applicants for licensure to submit to a criminal background screen for up to 5 years after the activation of this compact. And I also would like to mention that none of our border states have submitted legislation to be part of this compact. And if we were to have an agreement with a border state that is in contrast to this compact, it would be nullified. That's all I have, and I would like to turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Kiewicz.
Thank you. Chief
Kiewicz.
Kiewicz, yes. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Wayne Kiewicz. I'm fire chief for the city of Richfield, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association and the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition of the fire service agencies. While we are not opposed to the concept of an EMS compact, we do have grave concerns over some of the language in this bill. In the compact, some of the issues that we're most concerned with are the rulemaking authority. If you go and start looking through there, the rulemaking authority promulgate, the commission is has the ability to promulgate rules that have the effect of law within the state. The ability to have a public hearing on those rules is rather obtuse and onerous, and we find that to be difficult. If you look at some of the other compact languages, like the physician's compact language, their rulemaking authority is much more transparent and abides by national standards. We're also very concerned about what this might be in terms of an unfunded mandate to Greater Minnesota and some of the smaller rescue squads and fire departments. It does require a criminal background check with fingerprinting, and at this time, unless you're a law enforcement officer, entities have to pay the BCA for that fingerprint processing. So say you're a small ambulance service rescue squad in Greater Minnesota, your budget maybe is $5,000, $10,000, you could be, and you have 20 members, you could be looking at $1,000 for fingerprint costs with the BCA. And I guess you're going to have another bake sale to raise that money. So, like I said, we are not opposed to the concept. We do agree with that, but we are opposed to some of the language in this bill.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, then we will open us up for member questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe this is for the author. Don't go far. Maybe pull up some additional chairs.
If the page could get some additional chairs there, because I think the questions are going to be for all of the testifiers. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, and to the author. So this is the standard national language. So if we wanted to take into account the concerns of the testifiers, we would not be able to pass those changes and have the compact still go into effect. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Representative Backer.
Madam Chair and members, that is correct. This is standard language that has been vetted multiple times. So but that is correct. We would not be able to amend it.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, have the same concerns that they testified about, especially when it comes to background checks. And so when you say that it's been vetted multiple times, did it come out with unanimous support from the people who did the vetting, or who vetted it, and what kind of consensus was reached about this being the right language?
Representative Backer.
Yeah, before I answer, one of the things that I do want to share, and I'll turn that to Buck, he would know that better than I would, but language in this clearly shows that the home state oversees this. We as EMTs, firefighters, and so forth would not be like if we have an agreement with Wisconsin or Iowa, we do not follow under their guidelines. So, for example, because it was in the testifying, if there is an issue, let's say I did something wrong when I was responding to a run in South Dakota and I was reported, I would be reported to the Minnesota board. So I want to clarify that, and I'll ask, let you answer the representative's question.
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think probably the best way to do it is, and I was involved with a few of these nationally, just listening into them, is to talk about the folks that have brought it forward across the state of a national group. And it's the American Ambulance Association, the Association of Air Medical Services, Association of Critical Care Transport, Council of State Governments, International Association of Fire Chiefs, National Association of EMS Educators, the Association of Emergency Medical Services Physicians, our medical directors, the National Association of Emergency Medical Technicians, the National Association of State EMS Officials, which is our state EMS boards, the National EMS Management Association, the National Registry of Emergency Medical Technician, and the National Volunteer Fire Council. So they're the ones that worked in this group for probably 6 or 7 years, the design replica. From what I read in the bill, and you guys are right, it's a big bill. And what I read in it is a national platform that they followed around compacts, whether it's a nursing compact, physician compact, or an EMS compact.
Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll let others ask the question. I'm just going to make a quick statement. So I actually served for a while on the interstate compact for offenders, which is why I care about compacts very well, because the language matters very much. And members, I learned while serving on that compact that whatever the language is in the bill, that trumps, no matter what it is that we want in Minnesota. And one of the issues in that area was, you know, sex offenders who had to register in Minnesota that went to another state didn't have to register under the compact, or sex offenders that didn't have to register in another state came to Minnesota. There were different rules. And so I have some experience in how compacts trump what it is that local jurisdictions or local states want to have happen. And so you got to make sure the language is right. And if you don't, you get it wrong, and the state, us, end up having issues. Or, you know, some other state that accepts one of ours who has some issues may end up having people who we wouldn't otherwise allow to practice here. So I am concerned when my experts are saying to me the language isn't right. I mean, we have one who says, I'm not opposed to compacts, but I have concerns with what's here. So that raises tremendous red flags for me.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Backer, can you tell me what are the data provisions of this bill? I'm assuming that's one of the reasons why it's in this committee. What are the data sets that
Representative
we're
collecting?
Chair and Representative, if you look on page 13, that outlines quite clearly what data is collected. This data is same data that outside of any fingerprinting that's collected right now as EMS, you know, identifying licensure data. For example, if someone's being investigated for improper care, that's there. So all that information per your question is on page 13 and the top of 14. And Buck, did you want to add anything about that?
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I think that Representative Becker covered it.
Okay, thank you. And Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, Representative Backer. And I see the 8 provisions of all the different types of data that can be collected. And here's my question. When we get constituents that ask us, in certain instances, why did you outsource your sovereign lawmaking ability to a national group or foreign corporation or whatever it is that we've done on occasion here. Why did you do that? And, of course, we have to get a crystal ball here and look into the future and say what kind of bad things could happen on this. And I'm looking at the 8 provisions of all those things in there. And let me give you a scenario. Let's say all of a sudden the application and implementation of how this data is collected and how it's used, suddenly we object to. Wait a second. No, that's not what we meant. You didn't mean to do that. And I'm looking at page 19 on the first paragraph there, 19.1, Withdrawal. So we still retain the sovereign immunity to withdraw from the compact anytime we want. Is that correct?
Representative Backer.
Chair and represent. That is correct.
Okay.
And you are on the right page. Yes.
Thank you. So, but it says on that page, the top page 19, withdrawal shall not affect the continued requirement of the withdrawing state's EMS authority to comply with the investigative and adverse action reporting requirements of this act prior to the effective date of withdrawal. So Minnesota gets ticked off because they're improperly using data. So we withdraw from the compact. But the compact itself says, oh, by the way, the reason why you got mad and withdrew, you still have to comply with that, even if it's adverse to your inherent state laws about data practices. What happens then when there is a major conflict of laws?
Representative Backer.
Chair, Representative. How I read into it, and we may have a professional disagreement with this, is if there's any prior, for example, let's say we get it, go into the compact, and we're there for 5 years, so 2022, we decided as Minnesota to be removed from the compact. So if there's a situation, and when, let's say I was serving and I did something wrong in the state of South Dakota, that would still be part of that information. But again, the disciplinary actions would still go back to the state of Minnesota because it talks about the home state has that rulemaking. So that's how I understand that. So once we withdraw, if there's any incidents after that, there would not be any incidents after that because we're not going to any other states based on the compact. So it's only prior incidents is how I read into that. But do you have any suggestion?
Representative Lesh.
Okay. That's how I understand it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Backer. I don't think that's the way it would work out based on how I read it. For example, if a law in Minnesota were being applied in a way that we disagreed with, the legislature retains the state sovereignty to change that law and immediately change the application of it. And the administrative agencies that implement those rules would immediately change their practice based on notice that, yeah, we're going to change this. But under a compact, if there's other states that disagree with us, it strikes me that there may be a pretty major lawsuit that we're engaged in with other states or with compact organization or whatever, and a major fight would occur there. I'm not that language right there causes me some concern. And Madam Chair, if I may,
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. How many states now have implemented this compact, Representative?
Representative Backer.
I'm Chair and I'm Representative. We are looking at 7 so far, and then to implement the compact, there needs to be 10 states.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, Representative Backer, how many other states are going to pass it this year, or how many other states is this pending in front of?
Representative Backer.
Chair and Representative. Right now, there's 8 states pending. And one of the 8 is Minnesota. So there's 8 on deck, including Minnesota.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Backer and Madam Chair. I'm concerned if Minnesota is going to be the tipping state. I think there's a lot of things that we need to look at in this. This is 19 pages. And as Representative Hillstrom pointed out, these compacts can get really, really tricky, well beyond even what maybe the author had intended at some point. File this under seemed like a good idea at the time, right? And it could turn out to be, but there's just too many unanswered questions. And whenever you have labor and management unified against your bill, that's a giant red flag that maybe there are some issues that need to be worked out before you move forward on this. I mean, there might have been once in my history at the legislature where I had labor and management unified against my bill, and by the way, that bill didn't go anywhere. So, with all of the data provisions in here and the questions, I would anticipate, Madam Chair, that I would ask you to consider laying this bill over, that we have an opportunity to digest it a lot more. And the reason I ask that, Madam Chair, is I think there's a lot of information in here that is uniquely the purview of civil law and data practices more than, even than the other committees, and I think the gist of the work will be done in this committee. Can you tell me, Madam Chair, what's the remaining path for this bill?
Representative Lesh, there are a total of five committees this bill has to go through, and so I know this is something that you don't enter into lightly, for sure. And, yeah, I would just say I think, you know, we need to move it to government operations where they can address the rulemaking and some of these other sovereignty issues. And I had some questions, too, that I'll be asking Representative Backer about the data itself. So,
well, Madam Chair, if I can, I mean, I know you want to move it along, but I would like to move that we lay the bill over. I'll make that motion and ask for roll call.
All right. A roll call has been requested.
Carlson?
Representative Carlson?
Maybe if we can, before we take the vote, Madam Chair, hear from the other members, if that's all right.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To just kind of perhaps pick up on some of the comments made by Representative Lesh here, of the current seven states that are signed on to this compact, are any of them border states to Minnesota?
Representative Backer.
Chair and Representative Carlson, no, none of the states right now are. We have North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin are not them. And just one comment, there was a comment made by Representative Lesh. The international firefighters is part of the group that does support it. So we know that the local chapters have some concern, and we appreciate that. But I do want to bring that out, that the international group is supporting it, and they were part of the plan.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to that point, that would be where most of our cross-state, cross-border activity would be, with states bordering Minnesota. I mean, to your point earlier, it's unlikely that a lot of Minnesota EMTs would be heading down to Louisiana anytime soon. So doesn't this lay then some opportunity for some prudence in terms of our moving this at such at a rapid pace?
Representative Backer.
Chair and Representative Carlson, sometimes you got to lead, and it's a very fair question, but someone has to lead the pack. And again, I could appreciate everybody's concern, but we want to provide the best possible care. This has been vetted for 6 years with all these organizations that Buck talked about. So that is a concern, yes, but someone's got to jump it, put their big toe in the water, and I think Minnesota needs to lead. We've led in a lot of arenas. You know, we are recognized nationally for having an awesome firefighters and EMS association. We're the best, top five, if not the best. Of course, I'm partial. We all are, but just we are good. So we need to lead, and that's how I would address that.
Representative Carlson, follow up.
I thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bagger. I would agree with you. But with something to this degree of complexity, as well as Minnesota has also, I think, a history of showing prudence in terms of its leadership, ensuring that we don't make critical mistakes, especially when there are what I would consider very, very important concerns with what's being brought forward here. So leading at the expense of people's lives, I don't think is good policy.
I believe one of the testifiers here, Mr. Parsons, did you have a comment?
Yes, Madam Chair, and this is to Representative Carlson's question and a statement by Representative Backer. The International Association of Firefighters is opposed to this bill, strongly opposed to this bill. The International Association of Fire Chiefs are in favor, but the International Association of Firefighters, they were part of the vetting process, and they are strongly opposed to this bill.
Representative Dean.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So there isn't consensus on this in the individuals that have been working on it, so I would kind of be in concurrence with other folks as this still needs a lot of work, and we're really concerned that Representative Backer, you started with this notion of adjoining states and talking about how you go from one state to another occasionally, and yet none of those other states are currently signed onto the compact, and I would ask you, do any of those states have current legislation moving within those states?
Representative Backer.
Right now, none. Chair and Representative Dean, none that we are aware of, and of the eight, if there's other things that have been introduced, we're not aware of it.
Representative Dean? Was there anybody else on the list? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I keep coming back to this background check. I mean, many of our compacts, right, really look long and hard at Minnesota's background check system. And I know that you've been working on this proposal for a long time, but I want you to know that the FBI background check is hardly the gold standard. In February of 2015, the Government Accountability Office released a report evaluating the FBI's criminal background checks for employment purposes, which this would be. The report confirmed challenges with folks who were trying to get job applications due to the incomplete FBI record and the recommended actions to improve the completeness of that record. So the GAO report concluded that states are making only limited progress in reporting updated information to the FBI, which means that the FBI's criminal records database that employers are relying on does not provide a reliable assessment of many job applicants' records. And then the U.S. Department of Justice Bureau and the Bureau of Justice Statistics said that state arrest reports that go to the FBI database show only about half the states failed to include complete disposition information on at least 25% of their cases. And 10 states did not have updated information in the 50% or more of their cases. So despite the forming of all of this disposition task force and the FBI auditing that was supposed to be taking place, this standard that you want to base this compact on is not complete. Now, Minnesota is one of the states that does a really good job putting information in, but other states are not. And so what we're saying is we're going to give all of this background check information and all of the information that we're going to rely on who can come to Minnesota and work to this board, and they're going to be able to set rules whenever they want, because that we're giving up our authority to make those changes, and we're not going to be able to set a higher standard. So this isn't taking Minnesota's standard and applying it to the nation. This is saying we're going to go to the bottom of whatever the lowest state has, and we're going to accept that based on this compact. And I just don't think that that's right for Minnesota.
Did we have somebody else, though? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know you had said that this has five committee stops. Can you just let us know what those five are, just so I can kind of wrap my mind around what other committees I'll probably be hearing this in?
And this may be a question for the bill's author. The only one I know of, I've just heard this. HHS Finance and Policy, probably.
Public, Madam Chair.
HHS Policy.
Also Public Safety we have to go through.
Okay, so Public Safety, GovOps, will you be going and HHS Finance, and it's already been to HHS Policy.
We started, Madam Chair, we started in HH Policy, so yes.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. So we'll be hearing this in Public Safety. A lot of us are here or also on Public Safety, and hopefully you'll be able to address some of those things between this stop and that stop. And Representative Hellstrom says no, but
You can't change it. Okay.
Representative Chair, I mean, Madam Chair, and Representative, we also go through GovOp. So we got a lot of stops.
Yeah, Representative Hillstrom.
Madam Chair, the whole problem is we just heard testimony that you can't change the bill or the compact doesn't go into effect. So he can go through as many committees as he wants. The bill's going to look exactly as it looks right this second or the compact doesn't go into effect. So I don't know how you address the issues that are raised if you can't make a change.
Representative O'Neill?
No. I'm just listening to Representative.
Okay. Was anybody else on the list? Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Madam Chair, two things. I wanted to change my motion. And then second, correct a misstatement that I made earlier. I had stated that if there became an issue regarding whether it's the collection of data or administration of the compact under the version of which Representative Hillstrom correctly stated is invariable, you cannot change it. I had said, well, it'll result in this giant lawsuit. It was pointed out to me the language on 12.25 that no, we have rendered immune from suit any member, officer, executive director, employee, and representatives of the commission to even change this at all. So any of you red-blooded, freedom-loving Americans over there who care about state sovereignty and about our ability to decide what we do in the state of Minnesota with administration of our EMTs are just completely outsourcing it without any recourse whatsoever, which I mean, we just don't do this. The courts are always an option, and we're actually rendering them immune to. So this is, at least how it's currently written, over the top. Madam Chair, I'd like to change my motion from lay over to lay on the table and ask for a roll call.
A motion has been made to lay the bill on the table. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
No.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Lesh?
Aye.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Dean?
Aye.
Representative Hillstrom?
Aye.
Representative Howell?
No.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Lunan?
No.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Omar?
Aye.
Representative Neal?
Pass.
Representative Pugh?
No.
Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative Whalen?
No. Oh, excuse me. Sorry.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Yes. Representative O'Neill?
No.
The motion fails. Any further discussion on this bill? Representative Backer? There's Representative Hillstrom?
I just want to ask for a roll call on the underlying vote passing.
Okay. Roll call has been requested. Representative Backer, let's have some conversation after this committee about this. And I think the biggest issue here is it's unchangeable. And people have concerns. So with that, we will. Any last final words, Representative Backer? I should give you the last word.
No, Madam Chair, Representative, I appreciate your time, and that's the reason the bills go through the process, because you learn things from others. So I do appreciate people's feedback, and thank you for your time, and would ask for your support to move to the next committee.
The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Lesh?
Nope.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Howell?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Lunan?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Omar?
No.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Pugh?
Aye.
Representative Vogel?
Aye.
Representative Whalen?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative O'Neill?
No.
The motion prevails 7-8. Representative Backer, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Wait. Yeah, it failed.
I'm sorry. It failed 7-8.
Sorry.
Okay, Representative O'Neill is next. Representative O'Neill?
Sorry, I was waiting for my desk card to come down.
Oh, sure.
Your Honor.
Representative O'Neill, The motion would be to for House File 389 to be recommended to the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee. Is that your motion?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Go ahead with your testimony and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, after that heavy debate, I'm actually very happy to bring forth a bill that many of us here on the committee are on, and it's the Civil Forfeiture Bill. It's a very small movement in the direction that I think we probably need to go when we talk about civil forfeiture law. And Chair Scott, I thank you for being on it. Representative Lesh, Dean, Omar, and Lucero from this committee, and there are 18 total. I'm just going to turn over to my testifier to go into the details of the bill. So if you would.
Please recognize yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Bruce Rivers. I'm a criminal defense lawyer on the board of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and we're an organization representing statewide criminal defense lawyers, and I'm here in support of the bill. What this bill does is it opens the courtroom door to those who have been really, I think, the victims of an unintended victim necessarily of somebody who's responsible for a DWI that results in a forfeiture. Where I see this in large measure applying is where you have, I've had clients where they have a college student, they come home, they've got a prior DUI, and parents aren't home, and the kid uses the car, gets another DUI, refuses, so it normally wouldn't even be a forfeitable offense, and they don't have a seat at the table. Or you have a spouse who is put into a situation where they don't have any redress, and they're put in a position where they're considered less than a secured party. And the changes that and they're really subtle changes, but I think they're necessary to allow people who are the unintended victims of a DUI redress.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, do you have any other testifiers?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Small, and I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I thank you for the opportunity to come and talk with you about this bill. I think my letter is part of your packets, and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association does not oppose this bill, and looks forward to its passage and implementation.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill, Representative O'Neill. I think it's a good bill, which is why I signed on. This committee and the legislature overall has been extremely frustrated with forfeiture going back probably about 10 years, leading to some major reforms a few years ago. And it seems that some of those major reforms weren't, I guess, fully developed enough, leading to a necessity for this bill. But having been a prosecutor for 15 years, I failed to appreciate the full power of what the government can do to you with respect to private property. You know, every time DWI came down and some newbie lawyer would want to negotiate on the forfeiture, I don't do that. That's the civil side of the office. Go talk with them, which was really handy for me to be able to say. But, of course, one major factor of justice was a client who, you know, wanted their car back because their idiot husband went out and drove it and they weren't supposed to or something. But having been a defense attorney for the last year, I have seen the other side, and let me tell you, it has been eye-opening. One of the first cases that I took when I first hung out my shingle, a little over a year ago now, was a woman who had almost no money. She worked as a home health care aide, right? One of the last jobs you can get where you can support a family on. And her boyfriend at the time had driven her car to go take some cash to get a money order to pay their February rent, and it was late January of 2016. And the car was pulled over for speeding, and the guy that he had given a ride to, it was a loose family relation, had fled. He had a warrant, or who knows why he fled. Maybe he thought he had a warrant, he didn't or something, but they never caught him. The state patrol stopped him. But he left in the car cough syrup, a little thing of cough syrup. And the trooper who stopped him was pretty sure that this could have been illegal cough syrup. So they seized the car on a felony pretense, and which you got to have in statute, and held the car until they could test that cough syrup, determine whether it had too much codeine in it. Okay, well, months went by, nothing. So we filed. Now, this car was probably a 10-year-old Blazer, and it was worth probably about $6,000, right? So we're talking small claims court filing. She actually filed a small claims court, was given a date in June to challenge the forfeiture. As we all know, around, maybe some of us don't know, but the BCA on testing those things is incredibly backed up. They're very backed up, okay? So there was no crime. In fact, there was not even a charge because they didn't have a test that came back that determined they could have seized this thing. So they just held on to the car. We finally got a hearing in June, only to show up in court and find out that the hearing had been unilaterally moved and a month later. Meanwhile, I forgot to mention that February rent money that was taken caused her to be evicted from her place. So now she's homeless, and she doesn't have a car. So she's relying on rides from friends and family to get rides back and forth to work as a home health care aide. And the only reason I knew this gal was because, I don't know if y'all remember that young woman that came down here and did a lot of work on the medical marijuana piece. Her child has severe disabilities and would benefit from the oil or whatever, so she testified a lot. And I knew her. She used to be a waitress at a Louisiana cafe, so I've known her for like 15 years. And she referred her home health care aide to me and said, hey, she doesn't have a car, she's homeless and everything. So we get to June, she's homeless, she doesn't have a car. The hearing's been moved. I said, you're still not going to get your car. And I said, well, when's it been moved to? And they said, September. I said, what are you talking about? September. A whole summer more without a car. So he said, no, we want a hearing this month. So the court clerks actually gave us a hearing at the end of June. We got the hearing, and the judge, the county attorney, didn't even send an attorney down there. They sent a paralegal to say, no, the law is clear. We do not have to have a hearing until there's been a conviction. I'm like, well, they haven't even charged the case yet. Well, yep, we don't have the hearing until there's been a conviction. And I protested vigorously, prevailed upon the judge in small claims court at the time, who said, yep, I am going to give a hearing. And by the way, I'm giving you your car and your cash back, and you got to get that back to her. I'm like, thank God, justice prevails, okay? Well, immediately thereafter, the county attorney who had pushed this thing blows up and say, absolutely not. No, we're appealing this case. Files a notice of appeal. Like, this is insane. My head's exploding. Like, are you kidding me? They appealed the case, dragged it out even further, until we finally get to August, 2 months later, where the county attorney decides, okay, yeah, I guess we didn't have any evidence. That cough syrup that I thought maybe was codeine, nope, nothing in there. And she still doesn't have her car. So I'm like, you need to drop the appeal. Months of back and forth with the county attorney, still, when there's not even going to be a charge, there's never going to be a basis for any subsequent forfeiture. And months went on. We finally signed a stipulation to the satisfaction of the county attorney. But that was back in December. She still doesn't have her car. Now, yes, this was a long question, but I can tell you that I could not believe that we created a system like that that would allow something like that to happen to a person like that. And I'm asking the authors and the testifiers, if you are willing to work with me on language that would correct that situation so something like that doesn't happen to a person like that again.
Representative O'Neill?
Representative Lush, I'm always willing to work on you on with you on just about. I'm sorry, with you on just about anything. So we can talk offline.
Sounds good. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Beal. But I know that if the county attorneys say no on this, it's not going to happen. So I'm asking your testifier. We're working beyond it, too.
Mr. Small.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I was very interested in reading Mr. Rosario's column about your case. And I personally, after reading this, talked to Mr. Kelly at the county attorney's office. What eventually happened?
She
said Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We signed a stipulation. So the State Patrol that seized the car wanted all the money for storage and towing. And I said that this woman doesn't have, she's homeless, she doesn't have any money, you don't have any basis for the car, just give her a car back. And the county, it was big back and forth, so the county attorney involved was Jim Mogan, who I've known for 20 years, and we got into a giant fight over this thing, okay? But he was resolute on absolutely not, he wasn't going to deal with this. So we finally signed a stipulation that said no further costs would inure to my client. By the way, this was a 95% pro bono ordeal for me. She paid me she paid me. It was a very small amount. And no further costs. And then when we finally signed it and to have Mr. Mogan file it, I said, well, she can get her car back. And he said, oh, no, we said no further costs. She's already incurred all these costs, so she has to pay $450 to get her car out. And I just couldn't believe it. So whether she's collected that as of today or not, there were going to be some folks. In fact, someone else who read Mr. Rosario's column was going to donate the money for her to get her car out. So whether that's been worked out yet or not, I don't know. But I don't know yet.
Mr. Small?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, to answer your question, we'd be very happy, and we're always willing to work with legislators on this, as we did on prior occasions.
Thank you very much.
Representative Lesh, we would as well.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh, I thank you for bringing that your story forward, because I think this bill is really just a starting point. I saw a hand up over here, Representative Hillstrom.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and that is what actually concerned me, was that last comment that this bill is just a starting point. So, Representative O'Neill, I guess that is my question to you. Is it your intention to keep this bill clean as it goes forward, or do you believe that this is going to become the omnibus bill of civil forfeiture reform?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Boy, I'm just having a hard time this morning, Representative Hillstrom. So this is going to stay clean. I think otherwise we are going to have issues. It's already been through the Senate process. It's on the Senate floor, as is. When I was speaking to Representative Lesh about working on something else, it would have to be a separate bill. I don't think that it would be able to go through the process unless it was clean.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. The last question that I have is, if you could just clarify for me, I understand that we are giving innocent owners the ability to make it into court, and they have the burden of showing that they are the innocent owner. My question is, there's a presumption that says after a certain number of convictions that it is presumed that you are no longer innocent. So my question is, can a innocent owner petition more than once on the same vehicle, up to the three times or whatever the limit is, in the event the other person gets more than one DWI in that same vehicle? You might own a vehicle for 10 years. You might own a vehicle for 20 years. And we see that, you know, one in six Minnesotans has a DWI. But once you get one, a large number don't ever get a second. But once you get a second, you're more likely to get a third. And once you get a third, you're more likely to get a fourth. And so my question is, how many times can an innocent owner petition under your bill for the same vehicle if maybe they own the car for 10 years? Can they do it two or three times? And the presumption is that they can prove they didn't know up until three times. Is that what the bill indicates?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, yes, so up to three. So they could petition
until they get to that threshold of three, like it says in current statute.
Representative Hillstrom?
I just want a clarification of that, Madam Chair, so that members know that that's what you're saying, is that if someone's innocent and they their spouse or significant other gets the first DWI, they can go in and petition to get the vehicle back. On the second one, they can still say that they're innocent and petition to get that same vehicle back. On the third, they can petition to get that same vehicle back. And then it would be on the fourth, it would be presumed that they would know. I just want to make sure that that's the way you read this.
Mr. Rivers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, you can't forfeit a vehicle unless you've already gone down that road. So what the statute says is once they have three DWIs, it's presumed that they already know. And usually it's on the third DWI that the forfeiture kicks in. It wouldn't kick in after the first one, so there wouldn't be no petition. It wouldn't kick in after the second one unless there is a second degree or the qualifier. So unless that's the only way, so you don't get like three bites at the apple is what I'm saying.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, you would at least get two, potentially three. So I just want to make it clear that that's what the statute is going to say so that people are not surprised. Right? I mean, I'm not opposing your bill. I just want everybody in the room to know what it is that they're voting for. Because ultimately we're setting up a process by which people can come in and, for example, you might have a spouse that petitions one time and maybe the second time it would be the lender, right? They might be the innocent owner. So you could have the same vehicle be subject to this more than once. I prosecuted felony DWI cases in which forfeiture has happened, and I can tell you that you see the same folks over and over and over again once they get up in those ranges. I think the highest number that I've ever seen was 9 DWIs, prior convictions, right? And so ultimately somebody owned that car, and by that point, you know, in many instances these folks don't have much family left. I just want people to understand that what we're doing so that when people say, how can that happen, you know that can happen.
Mr. Rivers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom. But I think once you go down that road, that presumption is harder and harder and harder to rebut.
I don't disagree.
So.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Folks, we're going to take a 5-minute recess and come back and call the chair. But well, no, in 5 minutes. I'll call the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee back to order. Is there any more discussion on House File 389? Representative O'Neill, any final words?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just am very excited to bring this bill forward. It's got so much bipartisan support, and after Representative Lesch's long tail, there's more to do because this is contained just within the DWI statute. So I'm not sure that that particular incident would be contained within this, but this is definitely something that we need to do, and I thank you for your support.
Representative O'Neill renews her motion for House File 389 to go to Public Safety and Security Policy Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. We are going to reconsider House File 324. For a vote to go to Government Operations and Election Policy Committee. Representative Lesch.
Madam Chair, this was the vote on the bill for that interstate compact that just didn't pass?
That's correct.
Madam Chair, I don't think I need to remind you that public safety has historically been a bipartisan issue in this legislature. Rarely have we gone out of our way to make this partisan. This bill has multiple issues. It failed bipartisanly for that reason. And now it appears that you've gone upstairs, someone's cracked the whip and said, nope, you ran that through on a party line basis. You surely probably have changed some votes on that. And Madam Chair, I would caution you that once we go down this road, I don't think we want to go down this road of making a clear public safety issue a partisan issue. That causes problems long term in the legislature. I'm clearly going to oppose this, but I'd ask you to give some explanation as to why this sudden change from a bipartisan decision on the bill to a decision to push it through on party lines.
Representative Lesch, I think this bill needs to move, and I don't know that I need to offer any further explanation. So, with that, we will take a vote. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would request a roll call vote on the motion for reconsideration.
All right. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Madam Chair, can you...
Representative Hillstrom, I'm being told by staff here that we don't need a motion to move it to be reconsidered. We don't have to have a vote on that. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you do, and I think we actually had a vote to kill it, so I think you need someone who voted on the affirmative side or the prevailing side to make that motion if that's anything like any of the other rules that we have around here.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, sorry, Representative Hillstrom, I may have some disagreement as to who the motion comes from, but there's no question that this committee has taken conclusive action on the end result of the bill, and that was that it failed. So unless you're going to post this bill again for the next hearing, because the people who were here to testify on it already went home, unless you're going to post it for a subsequent hearing, yes, absolutely, it requires a motion to be reconsidered. Whether that has to come from someone on the prevailing side or not, I don't know. But there has to be a motion to bring it again before this committee, because it is currently not before this committee and is dead. And also, I would note that even if you did do that, it's incredibly unfair to all the people who showed up here in uniform, the firefighters to testify, who have now gone home because that was conclusive reaction on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representatives Lesch and Hillstrom. And as one on the prevailing side, I would like to make that motion to reconsider the vote.
Thank you. The motion has been made. We will take the vote. All those in favor of Representative Hillstrom?
I asked for roll call.
Oh, that's right. You asked for roll call. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Scott.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Lesh.
Nope.
Representative Carlson.
Nope.
Representative Bean.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Howe. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Lunin.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Omar.
No.
Representative O'Neill.
Yes.
Representative Q.
Yes.
Representative Vogel.
Yes.
Representative Whalen.
Yes.
2, 4, 6, 8. Wow. 8 to 6. The ayes have it 8 to 6. With that, we are adjourned.